The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 29th of October, 2020. On the podcast today, John Clark, CEO of Gfinity, discusses their transitional full year results, in which he says they've significantly strengthened their market position to create an exciting platform for future growth. Also on the podcast, Chris Bailey, founder of Financial Orbit, covers news from the following companies: Royal Dutch Shell, BT, and Lloyds Banking Group. Also on the podcast, as always, at the end, I highlight two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can check these lists out, top 10 versions of these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see lots of the content. In fact, there's one there from Altona Energy, also one from Gfinity, also one from Vast Resources, and plenty of videos there. Plus, of course, our COVID-19 index. The biggest riser on that today is Novacyt, up 10%, 10.5 to 9.28. Biggest fall is Cromec Group, down about 5% to 11.88. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Clark, CEO of Gfinity, G-F-I-N, is ticker there. John, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, pleased to be here.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about your final results for the year ended the 30th of June, 2020. And of course, it's a look, you know, are we three, four months away from that now? So it's a historical document. And especially when you're in a company that you've, you know, come on board in March and you're turning around and you've structured in a certain way to develop and grow a certain way. So a lot of stuff we're talking about is historical, but there are glimpses of what's happening and just a style of a turnaround. But for people not familiar, John, for Gfinity, just explain quickly what Gfinity is about, please.
Yes, Gfinity is a world-leading esports company that's focused in three areas, and strategically in three areas of A, what we own, B, what we co-own, and C, what the communities that we build for others, utilising our tech IP and our world-class production capability.
Excellent stuff. Okay, so just a summary here. Losses are down, gross profit is up, much lower revenues than last year. What is that saying about the business, John?
Yeah, I think as you just said earlier on, the results show that the business is in a turnaround situation. So the year to end of June 2020 was really one of transition, and I think it's a story that you and I have been discussing over a while. You know, we're changing the business. So we took a number of key decisions and actions to sort of position ourselves for success moving forward. Recap on a few of those actions. So in March we significantly reduced our cost base, sharpened our strategic focus in those three areas of what we own, what we co-own, and communities we build for others. We also took the decision then not to proceed with activities which didn't align with those focus areas, and in many ways didn't make commercial sense for the business. And we're starting to see those impacts of those changes filtering through, and they've been positive, and you can see that in our results that we launched and announced today. You know, the adjusted operating loss reduced by 36% to 5.5 million, and that's excluding restructuring related costs. The operating loss would have been reduced to 5.2 million on a year, which is a year-on-year reduction of 40%. Mm. So we're also expecting further reductions in the operating loss in full year 21 as our own revenue streams continue to grow, and we've talked a lot about that with the Gfinity Digital Media Group. And the full year impact of the cost reductions that we delivered in full year 2020 are realised. And then we also see further reductions in the cost base as existing lease agreements, for example, come to an end. So our gross profit rose 174% year-on-year to 2.8 million, despite the expected fall in revenue of 4.6 million, which was a reduction of 42%. So the improvement of this was due to a conscious decision to move away from lower margin activities. Mm. And, you know, and I think when we've spoke before, you know, and I always stress this, is that in this period, while gaming on the whole has benefited from the lockdown, we don't operate in a bubble. You know, we rely on our partners and our clients to have confidence in the business environment so they continue to spend. So we did experience delays in the sign-off of some products programs and the postponement of certain events. And, you know, you have to plan for those eventualities depending on what happens in the external environment in the months ahead. So we know that our future success isn't guaranteed. We've got to earn it and we've got to make it happen. But our focus and way we're doing this is by staying focused on our plan, delivering outstanding results for those who choose to work with us. You know, we're continuing to innovate and evolve what we do, especially in the digital media group, our partnerships and our tech IP. And the good news is that the team's shown there's more than up for the challenge, and the results are starting to demonstrate this.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, you've done so much since the end of period, you know, post-period, that, of course, you can't reflect in these results, but that's good. But Listen, whenever, you know, you see a company changing around, you see those margins getting better, the cash burn, a leaner model is always good and healthy, like I said. But people always say, OK, but they probably need cash. So what is your cash position at the moment, then, or the state of the
moment? Yeah, our cash position, this is a positive story for us. So our year-end cash totaled $1.6 million, and this was in line with expectations after completing the $2.25 million oversubscribed fundraise back in April, and the exercise of a further £200,000 worth of warrants prior to the year-end. So at the year-end, we had $2 million of warrants remaining that's still to be exercised. £400,000 worth of those have now been exercised prior to the signing off of the accounts. So this means that our business is sufficiently capitalized to deliver against all those opportunities that that are out there in this growing esports market.
Yeah. Now, I understand because of the formal sale process going on, you can't talk about forecasts and profitability like you previously had. But looking forward, you've spoken, you know, before about moving into month-to-month profitability in the first quarter of 2020. Do you still think you're on track to achieve this?
Yeah, I've been told that as a result of the strategic review process that we announced, I've got to be very careful not to say anything that could be construed as a forecast. So yeah. you've got to help me out there a little bit, Justin.
So basically, what you said before, you're not going to change your mind. Is that the case or what?
What I can say is we're more confident than ever that the decisions that we took earlier this year to focus on higher value and higher margin revenue streams was the right one. So we're now so we're now playing in those areas where we have a competitive advantage, and we've got that momentum. And I think it's important to stress the progress that we're making against each of those three pillars. So the first one of what we own, the Gfinity Digital Media Group, this is a major success story for our business. So at the start of the last financial year, we had two websites with roughly 1 million monthly users. At the end of June 2020, we had three English language websites with Spanish, Portuguese, and Arabic versions as well, with more than 11 million monthly users. Wow. So in last year, the sites generated revenue of £350,000. Our sites have delivered more than that in the past 2 months alone. And we're on target to deliver $2 million in the current financial year. And we've got brands like Samsung, Cadbury, turning to Gfinity Media Group to work with us to sort of reach that hard to reach young gamer audience. So we're seeing, you know, that's the type of trajectory we're on with the digital media group. You know, the second pillar is what we co-own, and this is those partnerships with leading brands that pay Gfinity for our services and who share the commercial upside with us. So if you remember back in May, we signed the 5-year partnership with Abu Dhabi Motorsport Management. In under 4 months, we delivered the first product, which was the V10R League, which we sold to three leading broadcasters, BT Sport, ESPN, and Stars Arabia. Season one will have been watched by more than 35 million people, so primarily in the US. So our commercial team is now out selling sponsorship packages against those numbers and bringing more broadcasters on board. Again, you're seeing that progress being made in that area. And the third is that building communities for others using our proprietary tech and world-class production. So in May, we signed the multi-year deal with Formula One to deliver the eSports series. The first live shows were broadcast last week from the Gfinity Arena. And what makes this different this year versus in the past, the show was completely delivered remotely with drivers spread all across the world, and that was utilizing Gfinity's proprietary virtual production tech. It was the first show of its kind, and there's multiple opportunities there when you use that type of technology. And yesterday we announced that Gfinity was hired by Red Bull to design and deliver the League of Legends simplified show that's going to be broadcast this weekend when the World Finals are taking place. The goal being to make this League of Legends more accessible to casual fans. So our production expertise is being sought by the biggest and the best brands in the world. And again, trajectory that we're seeing. So we're making really good progress against each of our pillars.
Yeah. No, it's sounding very good. And like you say, you are setting yourself up for growth there. And let's talk about this as much as we can, the formal sale process, which of course we can't talk a lot about. But what impact, if any, will these results have on that formal sales process that Gfinity, you know, has entered into then, John?
Yeah, I think the result's going to send a very clear message. It's, you know, we're a business in transition. You know, the leadership team, we've taken the necessary actions to significantly reduce the cost base and sharpen our focus and the operational focus of the business. And the impact of those decisions are starting to flow through in the financial performance. So, but when you're making those sort of fundamental changes that we're making, they don't happen overnight. It takes time. It takes managerial discipline. And then you need those proof points to show that there's potential for a stronger performance. And so I think anyone looking at Gfinity today will see a business that operates in a dynamic industry sector, and esports is still very dynamic. It owns its own community. There's valuable tech IP that's licensable and scalable. And I always like to say, if it's digital, it's scalable, and that's where we're playing. And it's continuing. We're being chosen by the world's leading organisations and brands to navigate the world of gaming. So it's a business that's starting to grow. You know, to accelerate that growth, it's a business that would benefit from a strategic partner. So I believe our results will stimulate interest. And I'm really looking forward to getting the chance to sit and discuss the business with all those interested parties.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, finally, Red Bull, phenomenally successful brand. Everyone knows them. I was listening to a podcast recently about them, and it's a really interesting story for anyone to look back on. But that announcement yesterday, all the markets were down. They were tanking yesterday around the world, pretty much. And my entire portfolio was down, and then you announced that, and literally against the flow. The strong current yesterday, downgrade. You, Gfinity swam against it and started rising. People could understand, that kind of validity. So, is that a one-off project with Red Bull, or hoping for a more long-term relationship?
I think it's a great, as you say, Red Bull's a great brand and a great company, and they're already a leader in esports and gaming, and they have their own gaming production team. So, It's exciting the fact that they turned to Gfinity to again design and deliver a 6-hour live stream show for the League of Legends that simplifies the game and making it more accessible. So this is a great one for me personally, because my oldest son is as fanatical about League of Legends and Fnatic's and a leading team, which unfortunately didn't make it to the final, as I am about West Ham. So this is great. We're doing a program that simplifies it, that means that I can watch that at the weekend and be able to converse with him on a different level about the game he loves. So, and I think if anyone's curious about League of Legends, then strongly recommend following the stream across Red Bull's main Twitch and YouTube channels. It starts at 9 a.m. on Saturday morning. I'm a very strong believer that if you do great work and show yourselves to be excellent to work with, then more opportunities will come your way. And that is my full expectation with Red Bull.
Yeah, well, I mentioned that to my son yesterday, that your news, and even they're 7 and 10, and they'd heard of League of Legends and all that stuff, so they're big fans. And like I said, do you know what, kids of that age don't watch terrestrial TV, they don't just watch gaming, or people on YouTube gaming, and look, even Red Bull have a look at their YouTube, their esports channel on YouTube has over 300,000 subscribers, so they're a big player there, aren't they? So to come to you, you say, is validation, and I suppose, again, it ticks the box, a rubber stamp. You can go to other companies and say, look, we got these guys, Cadbury's, we got Red Bull, we got all these guys working with us, and it's BT and Formula One. That's a cracking CV you've got now, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really where this is all about. And that's what I say. When we're focused, we have a community, and that's growing very strongly. And people want to partner with us because they want to reach that hard to reach gaming audience. You know, we have a partnership model of organisations like Abu Dhabi Motorsport that are have a strategic need to partner with an organisation like ours, and as a result of that, are prepared to enter into financial relationships that everybody wins. Mm. So And then you say you have big brands like Red Bull that have a very, very strong esports culture within the organization and channels already, but they see value in what we can bring. And I think it's always very important. So making sure that we can continually add value to the offer that we have for the world's biggest brands as well as the world's emerging brands.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's where we play.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, John, I want to ask you to do the three reasons. So I know you're going to be quite guarded in what you say because of the takeover panel. But it's good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time. Cheers.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Yeah, all right. Thanks. I mean, volatile old week, weather's raining outside. What could else go wrong?
Yeah, do you know, I never tend to look at historical sort of precedents or sort of setups or patterns, really, because I'm really bad at dates. But I sometimes remember a couple of Halloween's been quite bad for the markets, and October's been bad for the markets. Because I remember there's a guy on Twitter called Michael, who was this good joke about. And he keeps retweeting it, basically saying, "I'm going to a Halloween, party, and I'm going to go dressed as my portfolio because it's a horror show at the moment." And and it seems to be retweeted at most Halloweens. And is that the case? Do you recall Halloween or this time of month of October being really volatile?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, October's obviously got a bit of a reputation. I mean, you and I remember, just about 1987 and excitements around there. So October's always been a bit of a bad month. September, October, typically kind of two of the worst performing months. By contrast, December is one of the best. So it's always got that bit of a reputation. I think, though, you can always conjure up in the investment world some absolute shockers in your portfolio, can't you? So I'm hopeful that it's not a regular thing that listeners can rock up to a Halloween party. Not that they'll be doing that this year. Rock up to a Halloween party dressed as their portfolio.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? It's a bit, at the moment, I see a bit more fear to come. Like I said, we've got Germany, France locking down. I can see more regions in the UK coming under Tier 3 lockdown and pressure for Boris to actually do a national lockdown, because I know it's happening in sort of Wales. So I think there's a lot more volatility to come. But I think then we sort of have a window here. I think, within the next 6 months, we're going to have pretty vaccines almost sort of available for the entire world, So it's almost like I think we're going to have a big dip, a massive Santa rally. And as always, it'll be hard to take advantage of the dip because people will be so scared. That's the thing with stock investing, isn't it? When the fear's out there, it's hard. It's counterintuitive to get involved. But if you look back at all the times when we had that massive amount of fear in the market, those were the times you could have benefited and had a nice little bounce in stocks,
Yeah, that's right. The old saying that you've got to be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. It's actually a Benjamin Grahamism, not actually a Warren Buffett one, although Buffett has said it before as well, is absolutely true. The psychology of investing is always like this. And this is why some people say, look, this is why you've got to invest for the longer term, or, don't worry about active investing. Just do it passively. Just buy indices and everything else. And obviously that can work for some people. But I think most people listening to this, these thoughts will probably conclude that they like the game element of investing in the market. It is a challenge. Sometimes you get it wrong. There are wonderful stories associated with the ups and the downs. And there's just something intellectually very satisfying and hopefully financially rewarding as well from trying to time and beat the markets. By definition, we can't all do that, but I think there's a good element to it as well. So I would say, as always, you've got to battle your emotions. Any experienced investor knows that. And you've just got to say, right, what's the reality out there on a reasonable basis? And on that basis, like you, Justin, I am actually feeling all right about the world on a medium-term basis. Sure, we can all point out volatility. Let's say we talk this time next week, we might even have a result from the US presidential election to think about and try and factor in. Or maybe we don't have a result and we have even further issues to try to factor in. There will always be macro drivers out there. They are important. Nothing exists in a vacuum, but you can't let those things alone impact your portfolio decisions. There's got to be a bit of a fusion between things that are happening in the big picture world and also what I see is loads of companies this results season so far talking about how they're finding workarounds, how they're thinking about reinstating their dividends or actually reinstating their dividends. And these are things investors can jump off on and say, actually, you know, that doesn't sound too bad. I've got a little bit of cash. I'm going to put it a bit more to work in that stock or that sector or whatever it may be.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you set yourself up to, it is about patience, I think, you know, and the more I spend in the stock market, but it's such an emotional thing. It's hard not to, you know, to jump in with both feet first. But I think you can play a fund. I mean, you can buy a fund, it's fine. But I would suggest every time you see, you know, that headline on the news, say, and stock markets around the world have sold off massively, give it a week, top up in your fund, and that's all you need to do. And literally, and because you should see these sell-offs in that case as an opportunity to get cheaper stocks at a cheaper price, and that's it. And I think then you outperform the market, you know, simple as that. But it's harder the more actively you get involved, isn't it? Because your emotions get tugged into the market a bit more. But
precisely.
Literally, as a passive investor,
right.
You just do that. It's an opportunity. I mean, I think these sell-offs are often an opportunity, but not straight away. Let it settle for a while. You know, always, again, have a bit of patience, you know?
That's it. I mean, I think a critical thing is how often do you look at your portfolio on a daily basis? Now, I have to admit, if people ask me that question, I would probably say, in terms of looking at the shares that I own and what share price they are, it's probably about 3 times a day. And that might surprise a few people who probably think, my God, you know, you should be looking at it all the time. But reality is, I see how it opens. So I've looked already at sort of, you know, 8 something or other after the market's opened. I'll certainly obviously look at the close, and maybe once or twice, maybe it's 3 or 4 times a day. But to be honest, if you're not, the less that you can sort of get wedded to the screens, the more you can start to think about your strategy, think about what you're doing, and obviously reading loads of information and other stuff, the better you'll be. You know, prices are important because ultimately that's what you transact at, but unless you're a day trader, there's no need to look at your portfolio every half an hour, you know, living every dip and rally and everything else. There are better things to be doing.
Even though I do. Marvellous. Let's talk about some stocks with news out. So what are you looking at, Chris? What's the news today?
3 biggies today to talk about. It is, as I say, a mega cap, mega loads of earnings around the world as well. I'm keeping very busy today. Look, first one to look at is Royal Dutch Shell. So obviously it's been an absolute shocker. But here's the thing. If you look at the Royal Dutch Shell announcement today, it made me laugh at a certain level. I don't own the shares, so I can look at it objectively. When I read it through, I thought to myself, hang on, if you're coming to this afresh, you're thinking that this is a progressive dividend company. They talked about raising their quarterly dividend progressively by 4%, and everything is sort of hunky-dory. Well, we all know the reality that the oil majors have had an absolute shocker year to date. Shares are down 60-odd%, dividends been slashed by 2/3 and everything else. And you know, I thought Royal Dutch Shell, when I read through, there was sort of, they kind of stepped away a little bit from reality. Numbers were awful in the sense that profit was down massively, depending on how you wanted to look at it, 80% plus. I've already mentioned the dividend lack of progression. But what they're sort of saying is, basically, it's so bad that it can only get better from here. And it's interesting, you know, Royal Dutch Shell, I say, has had an absolute shocker year to date. Is it a company which ultimately is going to go bust? The answer is no, I don't think so. Is it a company under huge pressure to transition its business away from sort of classic integrated oil and gas things, you know, big honking oil and gas fields around the world, and then obviously all the downstream and midstream stuff, refining and related? The answer, of course, is yes, because that business is kind of getting compressed and being subject to emissions issues and everything else over time. So I think they're in the middle of a big transition to being a broader energy company, encompassing a broader range of gases and obviously some renewable projects and even some utility type things, none of which is the greatest for their profit forecast, because none of those things are as remunerative as classic oil and gas operations. So they are in a transition. It has been a right old mess. Maybe they've kind of hit rock bottom, and guess what they're trying to say in today's statement is, yeah, it's been really difficult, but actually we see a way forward from here, hence why the slack
cash dividend has been edged up by 4% on a, as they put it, on a progressive basis, which I guess is starting to tell investors that maybe the worst is kind of almost there in this space. What I observe from an institutional perspective is this: the most out of favour sector at the moment is energy. And you can understand why, all the reasons we've talked about, the green issues and related. So I'm actually wondering whether this sector actually finally is going to start to get a little bit of a bounce on the basis that it's so out of favour, and you're actually starting to see, as I say, a couple of small things going in their favour just because things have been so bad that actually even Royal Dutch Shell shares, which I've been disliking for a long time, maybe now at about £9 a share, maybe they are due a little bit of a bounce.
Do you know what I've noticed with, at the moment, there's a lot of traders, small cap traders normally, getting into Royal Dutch Shell, and it's been well followed on Vox Markets, and I thought, one thing I've learned about big stocks, and it's quite appropriate with Royal Dutch Shell, is they are like an oil tanker, and I would look at the chart and wait for a general change in the trend, because they can keep going down. It's hard to stop. Once the trend's in this, like BT's been going down for years, you know, you've got lots of these big companies. In fact, what's that other one, gas company, I think it was called, the British Gas, not the British Gas anymore, but it's got a downtrend for like 10 years, and that can happen. You can keep going down and down and down, and it's like, say, stay irrational for longer than you stay liquid. So I would wait for the trend to bounce to come, because considering how far it's fallen, this news today, there's only got 2%. It's not a big bounce. So at the moment, the trend is still down on Royal Dutch Shell. I wouldn't chuck my house at it now, thinking, no, it's going to bounce sometime, because it could just go sideways for a while or even down further. You don't know. So I, in my mind, big stocks, you've got to look at the trend a little bit, you know, because they can just carry on.
And I tell you what's impacting Shell, and this is why I reference sort of the institutional. There's this great thing that I look at each month, the Bank of America a fund management survey, because what it does, it shows you what fund managers around the world, you know, these collectively running trillions of assets, basically, how they're positioned in terms of over and underweights. And I use it as a contrarian indicator, because my view is, and obviously I've been there, I used to run funds that contributed to that survey. My view is that if fund managers are already positioned in a particular way, then that marginal dollar or pound, they may well decide to put elsewhere. And obviously flows of money, voting machine investors and all of that drives the market in the short term. So what I find interesting is that energy is right at the bottom. It's even more out of favour than the UK market, you know, and obviously that's very out of favour at the moment. So I think what you're right. I love that oil tanker analogy, by the way, Justin. That's brilliant. I'll probably be using that myself at some point. But the thing is, with the energy sector in particular, it was the most loved pension fund investment. I mean, anybody who's got a corporate pension fund, if you ask them, they would have had it, you know, at forever, basically, that and BP. So you've got, because of emissions and green shifts and whatever, there's people coming out of that. And that, as you say, takes a long time. But my view is fund managers are so underway on this area now that it's not going to take a lot to get it to them to sort of put a bit of money in, even if just to neutralise the bet.
I agree, but I think this ESG... you're right there, but you mentioned the ESG, and that is, it's a massive theme. And like I said, we don't know how long it'll go on for, but I think you're right, it's so unloved. Even if it's a technical bounce and it has to rally to 10% from here or something, it may happen. But again, the timing of that is unknown. And I just think there's plenty of time to sit back and wait for a proper bounce. It's way off, as I say, the 200-day moving average, which is often seen as the bull bear line of a trend. You know, that's now right now at 13 quid and the shares are at 85. So it's way above it still. So I'd let it flatten out a bit for a while. But I don't know what it is. I'm thinking, how will the bounce be big? Because like you say, it's so unloved. And then maybe if the bounce happens, people start taking profit anyway. So I don't know what's going to, you know. So again, it's one of those things that's worth looking at.
I think that's true. I think actually it's funny. I've done some fundamental work on it, and I'm finding it difficult to get to 13 quid a share. So yeah, my view would be it's a tradable bounce in the sense that you can make your spread and whatever else. But yeah, is it to sort of, you know, 11 or 12 quid? And then, as you say, it gets hit by a bunch of profit taking off those tactical positions. That's a moot point. Yeah,
but you know what's interesting, Chris, is that, you know, they often say, you know, the trend is your friend as far as charts are concerned, but also you could look at that fundamentally and say the trend is your friend. And as we know, the outpouring of funds from oil companies is massive, and that trend shouldn't be ignored either, you know. So in both technical and fundamental here, the trend is against Royal Dutch Shell, and until they pivot the business, which take a long time, to like these renewables and all this and clean energy stuff, which take a long time. So in my mind, I'll watch from the sidelines, but not convinced.
No, that's
but,
I have no, for full disclosure, I have no position either. So, you know, I'm just sort of manically musing, really. The thing that might, of course, change things is a quick $10 on the oil price. And obviously, oil is horribly macro, can be impacted by absolutely anything you can think about.
When we have a vaccine and the economy goes back to sort of normalish, the demand for oil, and when you factor in that I assume these big companies haven't been spending lots of money exploring for oil, and so the demand goes up, the supply stays static pretty much, or doesn't really go up that much, that maybe changes the price of oil, and you maybe get a run on some of these oil stocks, you know, who knows?
Yeah, that's right. You know, classic rotation in the market, which, you know, brings us obviously to other stuff like industrials and financials and other sort of out of favour areas.
Cool. What's next, Chris, news-wise?
So next one up is BT Group. Obviously, another one which you've already mentioned, Justin, has been a perennial underperformer for too many years, basically. You know, I won't bore you with the story about buying BT Group in about 2003 at a share price actually above the level today. Mm-hmm. But that's another story. So BT Group, what have they come up? The shares are up today, which is good to see. And if you look at the chart on this one, this does seem to be forming some kind of base at sort of about a quid a share, you know. And obviously a quid a share is a nice round number, law of round numbers sort of level. So, you know, that's worthy of note. What do they say today? They said that they're having some starter success in their push for fibre to the premises, because unsurprisingly, there's still newish management team. And the new management team in there, the guy that runs it now is, you may remember Worldpay, which came out of RBS, was quite a successful sort of techie, fintechy sort of type of business. The ex-Worldpay CEO is now in there, and he seems to be having a good impact in terms of things like cost control, refocus. They've, you know, stopped the dividend short term in order to reinvest back into the business, which is a smart thing to do, because ultimately stuff like broadband, you either got good product or you haven't. And for BT, they've got no choice. If they want a business going forward, it has to be based on broadband. Otherwise, they're suckered. You know, we're not doing fixed line calls in any magnitude anymore, and mobiles, you know, on its own is too competitive a market. So lots of good stuff there in terms of at the margin, things for people to grab hold of. That's why I think the shares are up today. They've still got a few challenges. You know, market cap of BT is 10, 11 billion quid. They've got about that much money in industrial debt as well, and they've got a pension deficit on top of that. So there's lots of debt there, but they did edge up their EBITDA, not my favourite earnings measure, but the one they use, their EBITDA forecast for this year. They are talking about higher EBITDA in a couple of years' time as some of these broadband strategies kick in. Not a complete shocker. I think they're working hard to stand still, basically. Numbers, revenues, profits, and whatever were down. So, and they're still doing that, judging by their forecasts. But, you know, it is a business of persistence. You know, many people, including myself, pay for BT product on a monthly basis. You know, broadband, mobile phones, et al. Obviously, they own EE. That's another one of their brands. Many people don't know that. So overall, I think it is kind of forming a base at a quid. I do own this one. I'm a long-suffering shareholder here. I did buy more when it did push below a quid a share, because I thought that was just getting a little bit silly. So fingers crossed, their strategy seems to be starting to pay off, but still a long road to go.
Yeah, well, this is another one. Even when I thought the trend had changed a while back, me and a couple of mates from the weekend podcast took a position, started rallying. The price went over the 200-day moving average, and then dropped, that was about 2 quid, and then dropped back down to sort of 1 quid. I thought, what's going on there? But we sort of got out at about 160, I think it was. But again, I would wait here, even when the 50-day moving average crosses a 200-day moving average, which is called the Golden Cross, which is called, you know, the signal for an uplift. That happened in September 2018, and it went from 225 to 260, and then it's grinded lower again. It just went down next couple of years and grinded lower. So, but do you know what? I'm looking at the chart right now, and it does seem to have hit this baseline a couple of times around about a quid, bouncing off it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. And so it's just broken above a trend line I can see now. And again, the 200-day moving average is only at £1.20, which is 108 already. So it's not far off that. If you can get above that, it's quite a, you know, it's quite a positive technical sign. So who knows? You may be there, Chris. You may be seeing some profit here, Chris. You never know.
Well, yeah, I wish my ink cost overall was a quid. I did buy some below a quid, but yeah. we'll just blur what I paid for the other shares. But but there you go. You know, can only
the chart looks better on that than the rolled up shell. Put it that way. You know?
It does. That's right. And then they've been a bit more sensible about dividends. They're saying, look, we're hoping to reinstate the dividend next year, whilst Royal Dutch Shell is babbling on about progressive dividends and all that rubbish, given they've just slashed it by 2/3. You know, completely false advertising, in my view. So, yeah, BT is a bit more sensible, I think, in the wider scheme of things. And fingers crossed on that one. But, yeah, good-ish numbers and good reaction today.
Marvellous stuff. Anything else up there, Chris?
Well, another quick one on Lloyds Bank. Yeah. So Lloyds, again, you know, I'm not a shareholder here, but anyone who has been a long-suffering shareholder, unless you've been very savvy in your timing, for all the reasons that we can guess. You know, banks obviously have hurt in recent months because of the pandemic impact. But, you know, strategically, they've been struggling with lower and lower interest rates, lower spreads on products, PPI issues, and all sorts of other challenges. So it's been a tough old backdrop, despite QE and everything else over the last 5 or 10 years. Lloyds today, a bit like what Barclays said last week, the key number and the key metrics are the fact that the payment holidays that were granted to a lot of people in the immediate sort of phase one pandemic panic, most people seem to be paying back or gone back to their payment plans or mortgages and other credit cards and other stuff, which clearly for a bank is great news. So the impairment level, the impairment growth at Lloyds has been less. And as a consequence, obviously, that's good in terms of their capital generation and their future hopes for the business. So that's why the shares are up today. They're sort of aping what Barclays said and others have said already this earnings season. The big question, of course, is what happens next? I mean, this is where banks are always horribly macro. They are double leveraged to the economy for all obvious reasons. You know, do you pay your mortgage? Do you pay your loan back or not? Is clearly critical for them. And this is where, of course, the debate about what's going to happen with the second wave of restrictions, what's going to happen with unemployment, what happens when furlough schemes roll off, etc. You know, how does that impact the business? I would observe that Lloyds today is well capitalized, at least on their numbers today, is trading about half times tangible book. So something's factored in for a difficult future already. So I think for this one, given it's got a fairly mature loan book, it's very mortgage-centred as a business, you could do a lot worse. My feeling is to the economy. So if you believe there's going to be a vaccine, if you believe there's going to be a bounce back next year, financials, yeah, a classic place to be.
Yeah, exactly. And there are another... Somebody argued recently. I said, I'm not too sure about banks, because I said, I don't know how deep this recession will be. I understand the market will probably recover fast, but the numbers coming out, I think we'll have a lot of casualties in business for a long time, and interest rates are quite low. So to me, banks, I don't know how long they'll stay low for, you know, like the interest rates. So it's a bit worrying on that respect. But I suppose when we see the shoots of a recovery or things not getting worse, then maybe the banks will bounce back, one of the first to bounce back, because further down the line, it'll get better for them, I suppose, won't it?
That's right. And they obviously, they put provisions out, and what's been a big trend earlier this year, say not so much in these numbers, were big provisions. And so they provide for what they think are going to be doubtful loans and stuff like that. They'll never get it absolutely right. And clearly, as we saw in the GFC, it can get a lot worse, a lot more quickly. They've learnt from that. Their books are better structured. They've got better capital positions. That doesn't make them immune by any case. As I say, it's still double geared to the economy. But is it absolutely life-threatening? Obviously, Lloyds had to take a bailout last time. The answer is, I think they're better set up. But obviously, the pandemic is a big old beast as well, with uncertainties to it. My view would be, at half tangible book, a lot of this is priced in. And basically, it's an economic play. If you think we're going to get a 2021 recovery of some reasonable note, and unfortunately, things like unemployment are lagging, but obviously, people look forward in the markets as always. If you believe that's going to happen, be it via a vaccine or be it by companies being smart, workarounds, people regaining confidence, whatever it might be, then banks, you would expect, will be and it would will have a decent bounce. If you don't think that, avoid it. It's a simple binary play as like that, but it is certainly geared, and certainly in large cap investing, you know, the banks are one of those sort of plays which, if you want to express a more positive view about the world over the next year, that's one of the first sectors you look at.
Yeah, marvellous stuff, Chris. Thanks, fella, and we'll speak to you next week.
Sounds plan. See you then.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Royal Dutch Shell. At four, of course, I talked about Chris on the podcast. At four, Cat and Eye Innovations. Royal Dutch Shell's up 1.3% to 877. At four, Cat and Eye Innovations up 16.67%. At three, it's Source Bio International. And they were listed today, actually. And of course, we've got a video on those, so check them out there on the website. At two, Novacyt up 10.5% to 928. And at one, it's Rolls-Royce Group down again 13% to 73.2 pence. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, it is Vast Resources, final results. At four, it is Escape Hunt, further progress in the UK operating owner sites. Of course, they're up to site, what is site 11 now, pretty much? Basis don't come up to site 11. At three, Gfinity final year results for the year ended the 30th. And, of course, I talked to John on the podcast today. And really doing the right thing, John, I think, there. Really growing the company in the right areas, in the high-margin business. At two, Gfinity appointed by Red Bull. That was this time yesterday, or late yesterday afternoon. And at one, Source Bio International, AIM admission and first day of dealings right there. Check that out, SBI's ticker right there. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.